Session number 10180, Reel 12.
Right. Well, when I left the Free French Flotilla in late-ish 45, I, of course, very soon became a civilian, and after that I worked for many years overseas, which meant that I didn't have any contact with them. And round about 5 years ago, I heard from one of the my ex-shipmates, whom I had met occasionally on trips to Paris, that he was planning a reunion, which took place in near Brest. In fact, we went to the little village, La Bervrac, where we had all been, which was quite an interesting and emotional experience. What struck me then was how young they all seemed, even though by then they were all in their 60s or late 50s. Of course, they had been very young when I was with them. We were all in our early 20s, and the oldest one among us was about 30-something. They also seemed a very dynamic and successful lot of people when I met them again, which again was interesting because they clearly were a self-selected group of people who had been very dynamic, very keen, otherwise they would not have left France and joined the Free French. This characteristic seemed to continue into their later life, which was a very pleasant and interesting thing. Since then we've had several other reunions, including one that I organised in our old base at Dartmouth and Kingswear across the river, where we met the local mayors and presented a plaque to each of the places which I had made by a relation, which I believe are now in the local town halls. And that was something they enjoyed very much, going back to their old stamping grounds, bringing their wives with them, who were very curious about what the place had been like and how many girlfriends they'd had in England and this sort of thing. So we've kept up a good contact since, and I found it a very pleasant thing. It gives them a sense of confidence somehow to feel that a group of people who were so objectively admirable as individuals still have kept this, and that I was once associated with them. It's a nice feeling. One of those ex-comrades who became commander-in-chief of the French Atlantic, based in Brest, funnily enough, and who recently retired at the age of 60, was chosen to go with President Mitterrand on a recent visit to Dartmouth, from which Mitterrand had been smuggled into France as a resistance agent. So this friend of mine and one of his...
His name is
de Bigot de Cazenove, who is now mayor of a little town in the south, near Paris. He took with him one of the petty officers of the flotilla. So the two of them accompanied the president, which I think was a nice touch.
How soon was it after the war finished in May that you were in Europe, that you left them?
Yes, in May 45. Well, a few months after that, because clearly with the end of the war, the war in Europe, that unit, which wasn't suitable to go to the Far East and was by and getting pretty old technically, was being reintegrated very quickly into the newly reorganized French Navy. And so, although I didn't want to leave them because I liked them very much, and I had still 17 UK ratings that I was responsible for and had to organise. Eventually, all of us were reintegrated into the UK Navy, the proper RNDR and RN Navy. So that was about September, I think. I came back to Britain in a rather peculiar, dilapidated old merchant ship which had been delivering supplies to Brest, complete with a box of about four gigantic lobsters, which were given to me by the local fishermen, which made the British customs very suspicious when I arrived in Plymouth for some reason. And after a bit of leave, I was appointed as captain of the upper deck to HMS Maidstone, which was a submarine depot ship tied up in Portsmouth Harbour. And I was on that for about for a few months, which was incredibly boring and useless. There was absolutely nothing to do. at that period, since that was early 46, I had applied, after seeing an advertisement, to enter the reconstruction examination, as it was called, for the senior civil service and foreign service. And I received a letter, or maybe my captain received a letter, saying that it had been decided that people in that category who were in military jobs where they could be spared could be seconded to civilian jobs. And although I didn't like the idea very much, since I had nothing interesting to do and there was no prospect of my being sent to the Far East, I suggested I should do this, and it was approved. So I was then appointed as temporary assistant principal in the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries. This was before I was demobilized, something like 6 months before I was demobilized. But clearly there was a big job in getting rid of people gradually from the forces and reabsorbing them into civilian life. So I worked in the Ministry of Agriculture, a lot of the time in naval uniform, because I didn't have any civilian clothes. And people all thought I was something to do with fisheries, but I wasn't. I was appointed to land branch, and my job was to denationalize or decontrol. My job was to decontrol land that had been requisitioned for ploughing up and growing vegetables and other things. And so therefore, all the secretaries of golf clubs and rugby clubs and people like that who wanted their land back would write, and it would come to me, and I had to make a decision with absolutely no knowledge of what to do about it. And this was very good training, actually, in administrative work. Plus, the fact that it was often quite amusing. We got letters from people complaining that deer were eating their vegetables and flowers in the garden and things like that. I also...
How did you go about making it? I mean, you say it was difficult to...
Just common sense. Yes, common sense. In other words, if it seemed that the land wasn't really needed for growing food still, and that it hadn't, for example, been replanted recently or something like that, the case was fairly easy. But I was given an enormously free hand, which was a very good thing. It was very good training. And I had been accustomed to doing things on my own in my liaison job anyway. And that's one of the features of Britain at that time, that people were given a lot of free hand and trusted to use common sense and make judgments. I was also responsible for something more complex, which was to do with the Small Holdings and Allotments Act 1870, as far as I remember the title, which had been set up originally to help people to have small holdings in the days when that still was important. After the 1918 war, it had been expanded to try and absorb ex-servicemen and encourage them to have small plots. I remember a lot of people my parents knew, ex-officers, for example, had started chicken farms, which were usually disastrous. But it had been an attempt to get people back onto the land. Now, that interested me a lot, because I had already, since school days, been very keen on the idea of small farming and things like that. That involved some interesting work. But after a year in England,
In what way was it
in? Interesting work. Well, it involved knowing the law a bit, understanding what the law was, and trying to help people who wanted allotments. They weren't really allotments in our modern sense, mostly. They were small holdings, but also allotments of the type we have now on railways. Wanting people who wanted them, helping them to acquire them, smoothing the way, carrying out correspondence with the local authorities or the people responsible for who owned the land or who managed it. Another strand, which was even more interesting, was helping in the drafting of what became eventually the Agriculture Act 1947, I think. Now, that was an attempt, quite a revolutionary one, to redefine the powers of landlords and tenants. And in a sense, it was a move away from the power of the landlord and giving more security of tenure to the tenants and allowing them, if in exchange for the duty to keep the land in good shape, allowing them to transmit it to their heirs, in effect, so that they had security of tenure, not just for themselves, but in effect almost became owners of the land, subject to certain conditions. This was built up at the same time as a much improved agricultural advice service. Now, all this, I thought, was very exciting and very interesting, because it was something fundamental, when you look at English history, in the way it affected the rights of farmers and the duties of landowners, because Britain was one of the few countries in Europe which had no longer a proper small landowning class. So that was a very interesting job, and although my role in it was relatively small, I feel very glad that I was associated with it.
How did you feel against the larger background of the Labour government which came in 1945?
Well, I had always, through the war, felt very happy at the way the whole, and this sounds like propaganda, but it isn't, the whole nation really pulled together very well. I mean, there obviously were black spots, but on the whole, there was an extraordinary feeling of unity and dedication. I mean, it goes from sort of vicars' wives and daughters of the gentry serving food to soldiers in canteens, and that sort of Lady Bountiful type of thing, to real grassroots cooperation when people were bombed or when there was a shortage of anything, or more generally in the country as a whole. Now, the 1945 election I thought of as a logical culmination of all this, and I was by that time very, very pro-Labour, although of course in the forces there wasn't any political activity, but my own personal feelings. And I also remember the propaganda at the time in the newspapers before the election. The Daily Mirror came out with a headline saying, "Vote for as he would want you to vote," which meant vote Labour. My first reaction to that was that it was a bit sort of sentimental and silly, but in fact it was quite a good thing, I thought, that people were being so interested in reconstructing Britain in a humane way, which followed logically on the fairly socialistic way Britain was run during the war, even by the coalition government. And an interesting thing, for instance, is that the army, the forces, brought in an education system to prepare people for civilian life. And even I remember giving some lectures on European history to my 17 ratings in a little hotel in Bénodet in Brittany, which is now a sort of yachting centre. So that Agriculture Act, the whole of that side of things, fitted in very well with the idea of a renewal, a reconstruction of Britain. It was a very positive period. But I found I got increasingly depressed in England. I lived in Brighton at that time, where my parents lived, and commuted to London. The whole atmosphere was a complete letdown. Of personal living was a letdown in contrast to the work. I felt incredibly depressed. I felt everything was flat. You know, you sort of suddenly stopped being active and dynamic and all this sort of thing in the forces. Everything was dreary. There was a shortage of everything. That was the period when there was a shortage of coal, and people used to queue up with buckets to get coal and all that kind of thing. A very cold winter. And I had always felt England was a rather dreary country anyway. So I was desperate to get away. And after a while, I had an opportunity to get a secondment to work overseas in the Middle East, and eventually I ended up for a period in Palestine. And that was very interesting, of course.
Could you just give us a brief review of your time in Palestine? It's not strictly enough, but...
Yeah, well, very briefly. Well, I had a very junior job, of course, but it was fascinating. I had previously never been to the Middle East. The nearest I got was 3 days I spent in Casablanca when I flew from Gibraltar to visit the American Navy there, from which I remember the lavishness of the American Navy, which shocked me, and the ridiculous conditions they had with over pampering, as I thought, and the smell of Morocco, which was a wonderful mixture of, I suppose, charcoal and God knows what else, a sort of mixture of slightly unpleasant but very exciting aroma in the air and a lovely atmosphere. So when I went to Palestine, I was expecting something interesting. The problem was, of course, it was a period of great tension, and I in fact stayed there until the British left. I was with one of the last convoys to leave Jerusalem. We went to Haifa, were put into the army camp on the top of Mount Carmel, and eventually left.
What was your job? What had you gone out to do?
Well, I was just in a department which tried to ensure that different bits of the government there, which was basically colonial office but had a lot of army and other units scattered around the country, that there was a sort of policy continuum. But of course, being very young and junior, my job was more or less paper shuffling. It was interesting. We weren't allowed to mix very much with the local people, whether Jewish or Arab, because there was always, first of all, the fear that one might get bumped off, and secondly, the fear that one might get too partial towards one side or the other. And although the British policy at that time clearly wasn't very successful, I think at the individual level, most of the people there were doing their best to keep a very difficult balance between trying to fulfill the Balfour Declaration policies, allowing for the awful situation arising from the Holocaust, and at the same time not stirring the Arabs up to become rebellious or violent, and taking some account of their rights as well. So it is very difficult. But within those limits, one could wander around to some extent and do a bit of sightseeing. I did make a few, not exactly friends, but good acquaintances with a few Arab students, for example, and there were quite a few Jewish civil servants. There was an enormous whom one met, and I would very much have liked to make more personal contacts. There was a great range on both Arab and Jewish side, from moderate to extreme, all sorts of little groups all competing. And as the time came near for the British to leave, more or less officially, or let's say unofficially, but everybody knew it was happening, groups of armed and political people grew up on both Jewish and Arab sides. And by the time we left, Jerusalem was clearly divided between Jewish and Arab. And even I, as a British person, if I went from point A to point B, might have to pass checkpoints. Once I remember being searched by an Arab after I'd seen some friends and I had a bag of books with me. Another time, one knew that if one went in a certain area, you'd probably get arrested by the Jews, and so on.
You say you tried to maintain an impartiality, but what was your opinion of the way the Arabs and Jewish were behaving at the time?
Well, at a very personal level, the main thing is you were afraid of getting bumped off, well, killed by some Jewish group, because the Jews at that time had organized groups who were fighting the British. That was the period, or thereabouts, when after a Jewish person had been condemned to death, a number of British sergeants were kidnapped and finally hanged. That was a great trauma. And I always went around carrying a pistol, a loaded gun. Never I used it. The Arabs at that time were much less violent against the British. So naturally, that coloured one's feelings.
Did you, when you mentioned the Jewish people coming in who'd had experience of the concentration
camps? Yes.
How did that affect your sensibilities or view of?
Well, it was very difficult because it seemed impossible at the time to let them all come in just whenever they wanted. There were thousands and thousands of them being brought in illegally, in the technical sense. At the same time, nobody liked the idea of having to stop them. And thank goodness I wasn't involved in that. That the Navy used to go out, for example, and intercept some of these ships. And as you know, there would be battles, not firing battles, but clubs and tins of bully be thrown at people and so on. Quite a few were injured on both sides. The British then thought of the idea of putting them in a holding camp in Cyprus, with the intention, eventually, of letting them in, but in a controlled way. Of course, this, to people who'd been suffering or who'd seen their relations or known their relations killed in concentration camps, was very, very traumatic. But equally, I don't know what else they could have done, really, at the time. There was clearly an attempt. We know now from history that there was a deliberate attempt by the Zionist organizations to bring them in, which is understandable. I was there at the time of the United Nations discussions on what was to be done with Palestine, because if you remember, Ernie Bevin, who was the foreign secretary, gave up and said, well, we don't know what to do anymore with this situation, let the United Nations deal with it. And the UN set up a commission which sat in the YMCA in Jerusalem, in the auditorium of the YMCA, and I attended some of their meetings, which were public, and saw the various members circulating around, etc. Their solution was to divide Palestine into two, an Israeli state, because the word Israel wasn't used until then, an Israeli state and an Arab state. And of course the Israelis accepted and the Arabs refused. And this is the cause of the root of all that's happened ever since. The Arabs were outraged that a bit of their land should be given to foreigners, and the Jews felt incredibly insecure, and the Arabs attacked them but didn't do so. Well, they lost, and so on. We know what's happened since. So it was a very, very interesting period. And
were you warned to take precautions when you went out?
Well, oh, yes.
An individual initiative that you took in
room? Oh, no, no. You had to be very careful. In fact, one lived in areas surrounded by barbed wire with a sentry at each exit. And you could wander about a bit. I used to go to the old city quite a lot because it interested me, and look at the old antiquities and wander about and so on.
On your own?
Yes, yes. But you got a feeling for which bits were safer than others. I wouldn't have wandered on my own into the heart of the Jewish area or into the heart of what were regarded as the sort of fanatical Muslim areas either. For instance, I never went to the Dome of the Rock, which always... I've only been there since, recently, which was very upsetting because it's a wonderful place. But that was considered a bit dangerous and foolish, and I would have got into trouble with my own government authorities if I had. I did go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for Easter twice. I was just there for two Easters, for the Easter celebrations. And that's right in the Arab area, but it was considered okay, particularly as the people who live around there are Christian Arabs, and they tended to be a bit more moderate. And that was a strange thing, too. I've got a photograph of it. The last Easter there, the High Commissioner, as was traditional, attended Mass at the Holy Sepulchre Church on Easter Sunday. And that's the Latin Mass, as they call it, which in those days was a week separate from the Greek Orthodox. And as he came out, he went through a guard of honour of one of the Highland regiments. I think it was the Argyll and Sutherland. And where they ended, there began a guard of honour of an illegal Arab militia. It's really very strange. And that was very typical of what was happening at that time. And I went to the church with a sort of guard of two Syrian soldiers in civilian clothes who were actually guards at the Syrian embassy, because I happened to know the Syrian vice consul, who taught me Arabic and I taught him English, purely for that reason. Now, these two were Christian Syrians, and they accompanied me just in case. It was... So it was it's a beautiful country,
were
and I really liked it.
Were you ever involved, did you ever see or were affected by any of the cases of the Jewish assaults from the British?
No, I didn't, because the King Edward, the King David Hotel, which was blown up, which was very close to where I lived and was every day, had been blown up before I got there. Well, a part of it had been blown up, although I knew the daughters of one of the sort of British Arabs, a sort of semi-mixture between British and Arab people who worked there.
How did they show their descent then?
Who, the Jews?
To you?
To me? They didn't. No, you didn't get any sort of personal confrontation. I mean, you walked through the streets and there were Jews of all kinds, modern ones, those who wore big furry hats from Poland, who were very Orthodox. And there were a lot of Jews, too, who had always lived in Jerusalem, who had never left, who wore clothes very similar to Arabs, but with a different kind of headdress. And I would very much have liked to meet some of them and talk to them. And, for example, I wanted very much to meet Jews who spoke Spanish. As you know, there is a group of Sephardic Jews who still speak old-fashioned Spanish. The nearest I got was a girl I met in a Nafi canteen once, who said her name was Estrella or something, some Spanish name, and said she spoke Spanish, and very pretty, and I thought I'd try and take her out, but I didn't. But there was no personal animosity. It was more that occasional groups of, rather like the IRA in Ireland, would suddenly fire at you. And I heard on the radio once or twice attacks taking place on checkpoints with the British Palestine police, who I must say were universally disliked by everybody.
Why was that?
They were considered to be rather brutal and tough, and a lot of them originally had been recruited from the Black and Tans in Ireland. Not the ones there when I was there, presumably, but the original ones. And they had the reputation generally of being tough, nasty, brutal. On the other hand, you couldn't help feeling sympathy for them because they were the main people being shot at. So it was just one example of the difficult situation at that time where nobody was right.
When did you arrive? Do you remember what month you arrived?
I think it was just before Easter, so it must have been round about March or April 40, 47, 47, yes.
And when did you
I left when it all finished, which I think was about April 48.
What do you remember about the leaving? You say you were one of the last...
Well, I remember this strange convoy of army lorries, army cars, civilian cars, which formed up and just went away from Jerusalem down into the plain, across the plain into Haifa. It seemed very strange. Partly like scuttling away, and partly a logical thing to do, to hand the country over to the people who lived there.
Was there any sort of demonstration?
No.
Left,
no, the whole thing just was like going off on a trip. No, nobody seemed to take any notice. Because by that time, of course, as I said, the effective control of Jerusalem and most of Palestine had been taken over by these various groups. You could say the British were very clever in that they allowed each community to set up its own militias and its own community organization, which was better organized on the Jewish side. Obviously, it was older. And so there wasn't a complete vacuum. You could say that. I'm not sure which is true.
And you left by Haifa?
By Haifa. And after staying in Haifa for a while to allow people to be gradually sorted out, I left by ship, and I think I went on leave.
How had the war affected you?
Well, at a personal level, I've already mentioned my feelings about the election and the reconstruction and so on, and the fact that Britain was such a dreary place. More deeply, I think I ought to mention that even during the period when I was in the Navy and the concentration on service life and action and the excitement and so on, one was always very conscious of the civilians. And my parents and my brother were still in Britain. My aunts lived in a part of London which was very heavily bombed, and they emerged as air raid wardens and Red Cross people with considerable authority. I mean, you saw these maiden ladies becoming really tough characters. And I felt very thankful that I wasn't in London being bombed every night. It really was very, very worrying, and the courage of the people was enormous. Now, I know it was much worse in Germany and in other parts of Europe, but no doubt it was a period of surprising ability to cope. It's not just something you see with nostalgia in modern films, which don't quite get the feeling of it right. It really was a very practical and healthy sort of attitude on the whole, and not very jingoistic. So that's one memory I have. The other is, of course, of how glad we were the war was over, even though there was a great letdown, which I mentioned. There's no doubt that very few people during the war really enjoyed the war, and the majority of people were used to affect, in the forces, used to affect a kind of cooperative bloody-mindedness. I've already mentioned how they used to say things like, "You're all for it, chum," you know, that sort of thing, which I wasn't like that, because I was more, perhaps foolishly, more keen, one of the keen types. But I didn't like killing people, and I'm very glad that I never did kill anybody, personally. I still feel rather regretful that probably through a signal I sent when I was in Gibraltar, a German submarine was sunk and a lot of people, all of them were killed. Now, I'm very glad I did it, because it probably stopped British ships being sunk. But I'm sorry for the people who died. And even though we were all keyed up, for instance, to rush in and torpedo a German ship, or the idea that they would be drowning as a result wasn't very nice. You just had to suppress that. I'm very glad I always was at the time that I wasn't the bomber crew, because even though what they were doing was rather kept quiet in propaganda, in fact they were saturation bombing German cities. At least one felt that's probably what they were doing, and I would have hated to do that.
You felt that at the time?
Oh yes, I was very glad I wasn't in the Air Force, in the bomber force.
How do you think the war affected your personality and your abilities?
Oh, I think it made me grow up very quickly. I think it was very good for me. I think at that time I was probably performing better than I have at it many times since. Of course, I didn't have as much maturity, and I think perhaps I thought I was being better at things than I really was. I made some very silly mistakes. I think I had a mixture of being very timid and occasionally being rather over-assertive. It was a funny sort of mixture. The other thing is, of course, that there was no atom bomb at that time. And so you could be in the war with a reasonably clear conscience. In fact, we had a very clear conscience, apart from the very beginning of the war, when I was still a schoolboy, when I thought that perhaps it was a bit of warmongering on Britain's part, that there was no point in attacking Germany over Poland because it wouldn't do any good. This feeling lasted a few weeks only, because I'd been involved in a lot of debates and things like that about British foreign policy.